SNI, Surgical Neurology International, and SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, in association with the Sub-Saharan African Neurosurgeons, are pleased to present the second monthly Sub-Saharan Africa International Neurosurgery Grand Rounds on the topic of global solutions to clinical challenges in neurosurgery. This Grand Rounds was held on Sunday, July 7th, 2024. There are two presentations in this Grand Rounds. The first is Cysticercosis, a review given by Professor Katanga Diu Merci Kabulo, head of Jason Sendwe General Hospital and the Coptic Provincial Hospital. He is also on the staff of the University of Zimbabwe and the University of Lubumbashi in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The second presentation in this program is by Professor Samuel Kaba Akaroya, who is the Director of Institutional Care Division in the Ghana Health Services in Ghana, and his talk will be on the use of intraoperative ultrasound in neurosurgery. This talk will be presented by Professor Katanga Diu Merci Kabulo, head of the Jason Sendwe General Hospital, and also at the Coptic Provincial Hospital. He's also on the staff at the University of Zimbabwe and the University of Lubumbashi in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The talk is on cysticercosis, a review.
Yes, let's get started. Okay. Thank you everyone for joining. This is the second SNI Digital Global International Conference for Sub-Saharan Africa. We have a forum where we can learn about what's happening in neurosurgery around Sub-Saharan Africa. The first conference was a success, and we're building on that. I think we've had some glitches along the way that I think we've refined, and so we will continue to build. We have a couple of presenters. Dr. Kaba will be talking about intraoperative ultrasound in neurosurgery, and followed by Dr. Kabulo talking about neurocysticercosis surgical treatment. And then the third will be a guest speaker, Dr. Samra Host, talking about teleproctoring in vascular neurosurgery. For the sake of time, I'll turn it over to Jim Osman, who's the head honcho for SNI and SNI Digital. And then we'll, after Jim talks, we'll turn it over to Professor Kaba.
Well, I think I don't have much to say except welcome. Nice to see everybody. And Estrada, thank you for all the work you put in on this. And let's hear from Professor Kaba about intraoperative ultrasound.
Good morning, where you are, dear seniors, professors, and colleagues. I'm Kabulo. I'm going to talk about neurocysticercosis. I'm a consultant neurosurgeon trained in Zimbabwe, right now practicing in Lubumbashi, Democratic Republic of Congo. This topic, I'm going to make it very, very easy because I know that even residents are following us. So I'm going to start with the basic things, and I'll share one case we managed locally, and I'll tell you about our experience. So these are worms in the brain. So parasites are organisms that exist by exploiting a host by obtaining nutrients from it. We have different types of parasites. We have protozoa, ermine, and ectoparasites. So, and a number of these parasites can invade the central nervous system despite the protection provided by the blood-brain barrier. And cysticercosis is the most common parasitic infection involving the central nervous system. And in some low-income countries, it's the most common cause of acquired epilepsy in adult. It is caused by cysticercus cellulosa. This is a larval stage of the tapeworm Taenia solium, which has marked predilection for new tissue. As you can see there, this is the larval stage, and you can see it has called collects. It has different parts. It has four suckers, and it has also two rows of hooklets.
Dr. Kaba, let me just interrupt for a second. If I could have everybody mute their microphones, because we're getting quite a bit of background noise.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'll mute all and then you can just remute yourself. Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Like I was saying, it is endemic in some countries, like in Africa, in South America, Southern Asian countries. You see on the table, on the picture showed there, the area in red, it is showing where the disease is endemic. And the incidence of neurocysticercosis may reach 4% in some areas. And the incubation period is very, very long. Sometimes it can go up to more than a decade for you to see symptoms from the moment you are infested. So the rate of neurocysticercosis are variable, ranging from 1.2 people for every 100,000 in countries like India. To neurocysticercosis are variable due to differences in diagnosis capabilities and other causes related to the resources available to the country, especially in low and middle income countries. The diagnosis poses a very big problem. Let me go into a background, an historical background. From the time of ancient cultures, intestinal parasites were identified as worm. And the larval stage of the porcelain tapeworm, Taelia, called Taelia solium, it has been recognized in pig for more than 2 millennia. Our ancestors, Hippocrates, Aristotle, and Theophrastus, they denominated them as flat worms initially. I think probably from Aristotle's Historia Animalum, due to their resemblance to a tape or to a band. That's why they were calling them flat band. Then Celsus and Pliny and colleagues, they called them Lumbricus latus, which means white worm. And the Taelia solium species of tapeworm was described initially by Villanovani with a term that reflected the equivocal idea that one individual could only carry one of these parasites. And later on in 1683, Tyson described the head of Taelia solium, like I mentioned before, after he saw the picture of the scolex of the parasite. Then he described those suckers, as you can see. I mentioned that you can see four suckers and two rows of hooklets. Then in 1855, Kutchenmeister identified the relationship between the ingestion of the cysticercus and the development of teniasis. Then other people described the cyst in the corpus callosum, as well as Mr. Watton, who identified multiple cysts in adipose tissue and muscle, thinking they were glands. Though they were not glands, they were cysts of cysticercus. And the evidence of this endemic life and its interaction with specific communities was clearly established in Dixon's study, where he found infestation of British soldiers 5 years after they stayed in India. And the currently the international consensus defines teniasis as the infestation in the intestines and cysticercosis, like the infestation in other organs like the brain, like the muscle. The life cycle of Taenia solium and the nitrile issue is more complex because usually people confuse how we get infested. It goes into three stages, the larva, the embryo, and the adult worm. So what is happening? Humans get infected by two ways. The first way is when we eat undercooked pork meat. So where they are, the worm, which is encysted in the meat. So when you eat it, it will go into the intestines and grow as an adult worm. Then you get teniasis. But the second way of doing it is by eating, by drinking water which is infested, by eating food which is not washed, well washed. So when you eat the eggs, which are, because the worm is, it has several parts. Those parts called proglottis, they get eggs. When you eat the eggs will go into the stomach. Then from the stomach, the shell get melt. Then the larvae are liberated. Then they can go into the circulation. Then from there, they can join the brain, they can join the muscles, they can join different organs like the heart, the eye, and so on. So these are organs which can be infested by the larvae, like muscle. You see this, which were described last time, like or glands, but it was the cyst of the larva. Then into the heart, into the muscle, into the eye, and also into the brain, you can find those larvae. So it goes into stages. These stages, they are like evolution of the disease. So when you get even into on the CT scan, you get different stages. The vesicular stage, this picture on the left shows the vesicular stage, which correspond to the cyst that have achieved immune tolerance. This is a very well-defined cyst, which contains a dot. The white dot inside is the head of the larva, called the scolex. And at this stage, you have mild. You might or not have edema, perilesional edema. Then the second stage is the colloidal stage, which corresponds to the beginning of initial host response. When you get the host response, then you start to get the perilesional edema. The third stage is the granular nodular stage, which represents further damage to the cyst, where the fluid content within the cyst are no longer discernible on imaging. So this stage, you see inside, you won't see the scolex, and the fluid inside start to finish. And the last stage is the calcific stage, where you are only seeing calcifications in the brain on imaging. And it's better to see it on CT scan, because calcification sometimes on MRI scan, you won't see it properly. So the type of neurologic involvement, you can get spinal cord involvement. You can also get giant cyst within the brain, which can go up to more than 50 millimeters. And those cysts which are being developed in the brain, they are of two types. The first one is called the cysticercus cellulosae. You see they are regular, ranging from 2 to 3 to 20 millimeters, and they are round or oval. They tend to form in the parenchyma and in the narrow subarachnoid space. They contain the scolex instead of the other cyst, which is called cysticercus racemosus, which are very large, and they grow actively in the basal, and they produce inflammation. So in this type of cyst, you won't see the larva inside the cyst. Where can we find them? We have different locations. Meningeal, where you can get in the dorsolateral subarachnoid space. Usually it's the cysticercus cellulosae. You can get them in the basal subarachnoid space. You can get them into the parenchyma in 30 to 63%. They can go also into the ventricle, especially when they're in the ventricle, they block the CSF flow and you might get hydrocephalus, or you can get the mixed lesions and also the spinal lesions, which are very, very rare, and sometimes they don't respond well to treatment. So the clinical presentations depend on the number of lesions, depend on number of the location of the cyst. And like I said, the incubation period can go up to 30 years for you to develop symptoms. The main presenting symptoms is seizures. You get patient adult onset seizure with signs of elevated intracranial pressure. Sometimes you get neurological deficit when the cyst is big and causing mass effect, and sometimes altered mental status. So you might get also cranial nerve pulses when the cysts are in the basal, in the arachnoid space, causing basal arachnoiditis. And sometimes in the subcutaneous tissue, you might get other cysts. So the diversity of this manifestation depends mainly on the size, like I said, the number, the location of parasite. And focal signs are frequently due to local irritation or mass effect. In terms of clinical topographical presentation, when they are in the parenchyma, you will get seizures. When they are in the meninges, you might get chemical meningitis. Into the ventricle, you can get hydrocephalus, and so on. So what is happening when you are sending now the sample to the laboratory? Sometimes you get, in the blood smear, you get peripheral eosinophilia. Sometimes CSF are normal. You collect and you send to the lab, they say it's normal. Proteins might be elevated or sometimes normal. And the glucose levels, sometimes they are normal. But the what you have to request is to look for over into the stool, and where you might get them in 33%. So the usual finding is the mononuclear pleocytosis with sometimes an average of 300 cells per cubic millimeters. Serology, unfortunately, sometimes in our center, like when you go in a rural area, you won't get this. You do enzyme-linked immunoelectrotransfer blood, and AIBT, which has effectively superseded ELISA, and where titer is considered significantly at 1.64 in serum and 1.8 in CSF. So false negative result can also be found. What else we do? Radiographic, you do X-ray of muscles, you can do X-ray of thighs. Then you will see calcification into the muscles. You can do skull X-ray, which is going to show you calcifications into the brain from the X-ray. And on CT scan, like I mentioned, there are different stages, vesicular stage, nodular stage, nodular glandular stage, and the calcific stage. On MRI, like I mentioned, you will see the cyst with perilesional edema, which is hyperintense on T2. Calcifications sometimes are very difficult to see on MRI because calcifications are hypointense on T1 and hypointense on T2. On spectroscopy, you might see a peak of lactate, acetate, alanine, and succinate. But the presence of strong succinate with a smaller acetate peak may help to differentiate neurocystic psychosis from pyogenic brain abscess. And also, if you check, you are doing your spectroscopy, you go into the cyst, you might not find choline and N-acetyl aspartate, but it can help you to differentiate a necrotic area of a brain abscess from neurocystic psychosis when you are doing a spectroscopy. Because when you get a tumor with a necrotic area, you get a peak of lactate and lipid, which are not seen in neurocystic psychosis. According to diagnostic criteria, in some developing countries, people are confusing this with the tuberculosis, because sometimes imaging can be the same. But now, the best way to understand the clinical spectrum of neurosis psychosis has been through diagnostic criteria, which are based on four elements: epidemiological data, immunological, radiologic, and clinical. There are these two associations, American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, and Infectious Disease Society of America, which give us these criteria to diagnose neurosis psychosis. They are absolute criteria, major criteria, minor criteria, and epidemiologic criteria. What you have to do, if it's definitive neurosis psychosis, you get one absolute criteria, or two major criteria, or one major and two minor plus one epidemiologic. If you get the combination of those, you can think about neurosis psychosis. Then we might differentiate it from tuberculosis, from brain abscess, cystic tumors with inside the brain, and sometimes to eidetic cysts. What are the treatments, what we are doing, what we are using locally here in our country? We give anti-emetic medication, anti-epileptic drugs, steroid, and surgery. And this surgery, you might do surgical resection of the cyst or the lesion, or you can do CSF diversion. Steroids are very, very important, because when you are about to start medical treatment, you have to give steroid first to reduce the amount of edema. Otherwise, the patient will deteriorate while you are giving anti-emetic drug. And in our setting, what we are doing with the steroid, we start with dexamethasone, 8 milligrams, 8 hourly. Then on day 3, we decrease the dose to 4 milligrams, 8 hourly. And on day 6, we change now dexamethasone to prednisolone. And at that moment, we introduce now our anti-emetic drugs. So anti-epileptic, they respond very well. Usually it's one only. You won't even go to 2 drugs. You give one, and usually they respond well. And the risk for seizures, it's when you get calcified brain lesions, when the patient is presenting with multiple seizures, and when you get multiple brain cysts.
Jorge, do you want to introduce Luisa from Mexico?
Just wanted to say briefly, Dr. Arredondo has been introduced to us as one of the shining and bright figures in Mexican neurosurgery. He's in Guadalajara, and with that introduction, I mean, he came highly recommended by all my senior colleagues from the country. So, Dr. Arredondo, you continue with your opinions about this subject of cystic sarcosis and the central nervous system.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lazareve. Can you hear me? Everyone, can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you for the kind introduction. Cystic sarcosis in Mexico, as in many other development countries, is a major problem, and still is health services public problem, and we have a major incidence of this disease in the last 5 years, which has been decreased from the first years of the 90s. We have in 1996, for example, about 1,600 cases per year, and in the last register in 2022, we have 225 cases. So we are seeing a diminished in the cases and in our country, and the major problem is, of course, the lack of preventive measures in the preparation of the food, and the prevalence of the street food in Mexico.
So you noticed a decrease in the incidence. What do you attribute that to?
I think there is a major information and more education among the population, and I think it's because people are preparing best their foods and they are aware of being in risk of being with to acquire the disease in if they don't have the measures to take care of the food.
By the way, how do these people present to neurosurgery, with seizures or mass effect?
Most of them present with seizures, but some few cases are present with mass lesions. And the most prevalent form of cysticercosis is the parenchyma cysticercosis. And we have seen every day less cases of hydrocephalus associated with this disease.
Hello, Professor. I'm sorry, my network was bad. Can you hear me?
Yes,
I can hear you.
We were just hearing from Luis about his experience in Mexico, and actually your slides at the right time, because I was going to ask Luis, now that you're back, Cabullo, what are the drugs you use to treat them and how successful are they?
I'm almost at the end.
Please
can I proceed, Professor?
Okay, yes,
thank you so much. So I think we use Praziquantel, 50 milligrams per kg, and we divide it into three doses. Then the most used is albendazole, 15 milligrams per kg per day. Then we divide into two to 3 days. But we have to start first with steroid first before we introduce this one. Then how do we prevent them? It's measures, sanitary education, which is the most important strategy to control this disease, and hand washing, also installation of latrines or other hygienic measures for disposal of human waste. And in surgery may be used to establish the diagnosis. You can do the biopsy to get the definitive diagnosis. You can do stereotactic biopsy, which is well suited for small lesions, and CSF diversion. You do a ventricular peritoneal shunt to treat hydrocephalus. Surgery also might be indicated for spinal cyst, intraventricular cyst, which may be less responsible to medical therapy. When you get intraventricular, that's where people sometimes they do it endoscopically to go and remove the cyst into the ventricle. Otherwise, you get hydrocephalus. And the spinal cyst, once it grows, it will compress. You get the neurological deficit related to that. And surgery may also be used for giant cyst when intracranial hypertension does not respond to steroid. But though every case you are operating, you have to continue after the surgery, you have to continue with anti-emetic drugs to complete the treatment. And follow up, we always do CT scan every 6 months until the lesions disappear completely into the brain. I will show you a 46-year-old male who was diagnosed with neurocysticercosis, and he went at the local facility. You see the picture here. This is the vesicular stage. You can see the lesions with a white dot inside. This is the scolex. This patient went somewhere and he received albendazole without giving steroid. The patient deteriorated. The Glasgow Coma Scale dropped up to 9/15. So he could not walk, he could not talk for 2 years. Then this patient was referred to us. The moment the patient came to us, we did a CT scan control. This was the CT scan. It was now the calcified stage. You see only calcifications you can see into the brain parenchyma with active hydrocephalus. Then we shunted this patient
After shunting, a month later, the patient could walk and could pronounce a few words. Today, we are almost 4 months post CSF diversion, and we are planning to do a CT scan, though it's a very poor patient who could not even do a CT scan control soon after the diversion.
I think we just lost him again, but it was very, very, very good talk, Professor Cabullo. Luis, any more comments? What you just saw?
I have a question for Dr. I don't remember the name.
Dr. Cabullo.
Cabullo, Dr. Cabullo, excuse me.
He may not be connected. I think he got disconnected.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering how many shunt failures they have in their practice, or because the failure of the shunt in my country is very high because of this disease. So we need to do a revision of the shunt failure most than 2 or 3 times because of cysticercosis. I don't know what is the amount of revision of the shunt in his country.
Is that because of protein in the shunt, or
that's the main cause of the protein in the CSF, and it's not related mainly to the technique, but it's related, yes, to the protein content.
Are these shunts commercial shunts, or do you have shunts in Mexico that you make in Mexico that you use, or are they straight tubes?
No, most of the shunts come from South America. We don't have shunts made in our country. In the past years, we have shunts made in Mexico, but it's no more available, those shunts.
Okay. So with praziquintal and albendazole, what's the expectation for the reduction of the CSF protein content?
We need to expect at least 1 or 2 weeks to the proteins to decrease in the CSF. But sometimes we need to put a shunt very early, and we have a very high index of failure in the shunts.
Right. Thank you.
Well, we just got the end of Dr. Cabullo. It was a wonderful presentation, Dr. Cabullo. So as a neurosurgeon, do you see hydrocephalus as the most common? Do you see a large cyst is the most common? Do you see, what's your experience in Mexico? And then Cabullo can tell us and what he sees in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
The parenchymal presentation is most common. We personally, I have not made a surgery in the past 1 year related to neurocysticercosis, which resembles the decrease of the incidence of the disease, but mostly of the presentations are parenchymal, and fortunately not related to hydrocephalus, because the percentage of failure in shunts is very high.
There's a question in the chat about the option of external ventricular drainage before placing in a permanent shunt.
Yes, we use that. Yes.
Okay. I think Estrada Alvin wanted to ask a question.
Yes, Alvin has your yes. Doc, Alvin, please go ahead. You have your hand raised.
Thank you, professors. So, Dr. Cabullo, thanks for that brief presentation. I just want to know, what is the rationale of changing the steroids? You started with dexamethasone, and then you say after 72 hours, and then you gave prednisolone. Is there any, I don't know, I just need to know what is the rationale. Why can't us continue with just one, either dexamethasone? Why should it be changed to another steroid? Thank you so much. Beautiful presentation.
Anybody answer the question about changing steroids? It's from a high dose, it's a high dose to a low dose is, I guess, what I got out of that. But anybody in the audience have experience with that?
I think Dr. Gabula, I think Dr. Dog was indicating that there was a change of the steroid type.
It looked to me like they wanted to prevent steroid dependence, but Jorge, do you know anything about that?
No, I would imagine that the patient dictates the dose and the opportunity, no? But I don't have any deep knowledge about that, no. Not at all.
I think it may be because the prednisolone or prednisone in our countries is much more available in oral presentation, and dexamethasone is intravenous presentation. I think that's the origin of the change.
Ignatius, do you have any experience in Cameroon with this, or Sam? And yeah, go ahead, Ignatius. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Kabulu. That was a very excellent presentation. I actually work in the northern part of Cameroon and it's majority Muslims. So for the past 4 years, I've just had two cases of neurocystic psychosis. And we actually even wrote a case report about a lady who was initially a Christian, and she used to eat pork and then later converted to become a Muslim. But when we found a neurocystic psychosis in this case, we were a bit embarrassed, you know. So I don't have much experience with that. I've just had two cases over 4 years. And these were intraparenchymal cases. The patient presented with seizures. We managed the seizures and then with anti-helminthic drugs, and the patient recovered without any problems.
Sam, do you see this in Nigeria?
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the presentation indeed. Nigeria, strangely enough, we eat a lot of pork in Nigeria. And this disease is it's not uncommon in Nigeria, but I have not encountered one neurosurgical case over the so many years I've practiced in Nigeria. It's a bit strange. Maybe we're missing them. We have all the diagnostic tools to be able to make the diagnosis, but I can't recall that we have treated any in my center.
Okay.
Dr. Osman. Yes. If I had, we hear in our neurosurgery conference at UCLA from time to time that the patients who had the cystic sarcosis, we had last year one from the spinal cord, they removed it completely without a rupture. And also I see many patients who immigrated from Mexico to Los Angeles. They come with seizure and they are on the anti-epileptic because of the cystic sarcosis. Unfortunately, this is the topic that is very insisted on neurosurgery, and they try to teach it, especially the medication the doctor presented is the one which is used. And also it was a beautiful, beautiful presentation of this, because this is the topic I used to teach with Dr. Jorge Lazarev in the class for the students, just to make them aware, and your talk was excellent, and really I appreciate. And we see that in Los Angeles, we see it, especially the county hospital, we have the cases from time to time, and they know it very well, and they handle it beautifully because of the cases that we see. Thank you very much.
Mariela from Cuba, do you see this in Cuba at all, Mariela?
No, in Cuba it's very infrequent. I never seen I never seen in Cuba the neurocystic sarcosis.
Okay, but it looks like Ignatius or Nim or Professor Kabulo that it's in concentrated in different areas of Africa. Is that true?
Yes. As I mentioned before, I work in the majority Muslim community, whereas Kabulo works in Lumumbashi, and I think it's a mixed community with the majority Christians. So Christians eat pork, but Muslims don't. So, for example, during my training, I was in Cairo. I didn't, over 7 years, I didn't see a case of neurocystic psychosis in Cameroon. I've seen two. So I think that explains why Kabulu maybe has seen so many cases, whereas we are seeing very few.
Okay.
Nim had indicated that he had invited Dr. Okimwa to make
Dr. Okimwa.
Oh, Dr. yes, that's right. Please do.
Yeah, Dr. Okimwa couldn't make it.
Okay.
Dr. Okimwa couldn't make it. He's a neuropathologist. But we rarely see neurocystic psychosis in Kenya. Of all the years I've worked, we haven't done a surgery. I never did a single surgery. Dr. Kiboy, I think, is on this call. If Dr. Kiboy is now working at Kenyatta National Hospital, he could give us his comments. But yeah, Dr. Kiboy.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's true. We don't see a lot of patients with neuropsychosis in our setup, but that was a very good presentation. Really showcasing what we see in our country is more hydatid cyst. The hydatid is common in our northern part of our country, and Professor, you are very much aware about our hydatid cyst and we have. But that very good presentation, and thank you very much.
Okay,
thank you.
I could comment. I mean, it was a wonderful presentation, and very, very informative, because I really don't know when I last revised neurocystic psychosis, because as I said, we rarely see it. Hydatid disease is very common in our setup. Now, in our population, we have although the Muslim population is about 10%, majority is Christians, but still we don't see neurocystic psychosis. I have discussed this with our physicians as to whether maybe they treat the condition, but even the physicians, our neurophysicians, they told me they don't see it. So I think this is one area would like to do, to go a step forward. I would like to follow up this with my colleagues in DRC to find out how come they see these cases and we don't see them. What's the epidemiological factor? What is the reason? You know, we would like, because the hygienic factors, the exposure factors are the same. So if that was there, we should be seeing these cases. So I really don't know why we don't see them. And this is why I wanted our neuropathologist to come and give me his views. But we do see cystic psychosis. We see cystic psychosis. It's a common problem in our country, but we don't see neurocystic psychosis. Thanks.
Dr. Estrada, if you permit. Dr. King is
raising the hand. I mean, yeah. Yes. We have a raised hand. We should probably go on to Dr. Kawa's presentation, but let's hear from Dr. King, who has his hands raised. And there are questions in the chat, so if people can answer in the chat, that would be great. Go ahead, Paul. You're on mute.
You can hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, I just had a comment. One, that Dr. Kabula's talk was outstanding. And I, all the times that I've traveled to Africa, I've not seen cystic psychosis, but in America, I've treated about 10 patients with cystic psychosis. And I think that we got to be aware, and our residents have to be aware of this problem, because we have so many immigrants. And we can't forget about cystic psychosis, because it's alive and well. And so I think that we have to keep that in our differential when treating patients, especially immigrants from all over the world.
Excellent, Paul. Saeed?
Yes, doctor, question. I wanted to mention that in south of Iran, which is a Muslim country, we have a lot of hydatidism. And as everybody knows, the animal involved is the dog. It's the worm, the parasite grows in the intestine of the dog. And because of their excrement in the area, the people who get contaminated and it goes, then the treatment is totally different. And we had some talks from our colleague from Iraq who had a lot of cases like that. So it's a contrast. Those who has in the Muslim world, if the dogs are in contaminated, hydatidism is very prevalent and sometimes very deadly. and those we have the pork using cystic sarcosis. And in the talk we had at UCLA, they have never seen a high-density cyst, at least at UCLA, as up to now, because the animals are quarantined before coming to US and Canada. But there have been some cases from East Europe who have immigrated to Canada, 4 cases, they were contaminated with the high-density cyst. Thank you, Ali.
Dr. Cabullo, you raised your hand and then we had to move on, I guess. But first of all, just a wonderful talk, very nicely done, very informative. You want to make some comments?
Thank you so much, Professor. I'm very sorry about my network. Very sorry for that. I wanted to answer the question about changing steroid. When we give dexamethasone, it's injection, then imagine someone who comes with neurocystic sarcosis with no surgical indication, and you can't keep the patient for 10 days in the hospital while receiving steroid. Imagine dexamethasone, the tablets here, they are 0.5 milligrams. If you want to give 8 milligrams, it means the patient has to take 16 or more than that tablets at once. So if you go to dexamethasone, to prednisolone, it will be few tablets. Then you discharge your patient. The patient continues the medication at home with the albendazole instead of keeping the patient with dexamethasone for long and injection and long period for oral or for injection of dexamethasone only in the hospital. That's the reason why we change. We change because with prednisolone, you take less pills than dexamethasone. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. Excellent.
Cabullo, one other question. Why do you see it more commonly in your country as opposed to others? Do you know?
Yes, we see neurocystic sarcosis, and those we are operating, they are less than those we are treating medically. Right. Even recently, we gave a tablet to one of our colleagues, doctor, who had neurocystic sarcosis, but with no hydrocephalus. He came already in the calcified stage, and we gave a tablet, and everything went well. So we see more of these cases. Like I can say I have, for 4 years, I have more than 30 cases of neurocystic sarcosis.
So the presentation, I would guess, to neurosurgeons is parenchymal from seizures, maybe acutely from hydrocephalus. And the drug treatments, are they very successful or not?
Yes. Many of them, they come with seizures. Adult onset seizure, when you do CT scan, you get the diagnosis. And
this presentation will be given by Professor Samuel Caba Acaroya, who is the Director of Institutional Care Division of Ghana Health Services in Ghana. His talk will be on the use of intraoperative ultrasound in neurosurgery.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right, so thank you so very much for this great opportunity and to all colleagues who are online. I'm going to be talking about intraoperative ultrasound, and I'll do my best to do it as quick as possible. And just one disclaimer, I'm not actually a radiologist, I'm a neurosurgeon, but I think this is the future tool for low resource setup. I don't have so much experience. This is my fourth year of experience in ultrasound, transoperative. I don't think that is a lot of experience, but I just believe that is the future. Now, why so? Because most of the time we talk about intraoperative MRI, we talk of intraoperative CT scan and all that. These are quite expensive. And in most countries, in the developing countries, should we even have them right now? You got to break down your theater. You need to build a new place to put them. But with the ultrasound, you easily go on without having to make any changes. Let me see. All right, so there we go. Good. So ultrasound is just a machine that uses high frequency sound waves to view inside to view inside the body. All right. So with that, the images are captured in real time, and that is a good thing because you see everything you're doing, including the blood flow. And now, just a little history, just to say that Tom Brown and obstetrician Ian Donald, way back in 1956, decided to use the first prototype. And of course, as gynecologists, they use it for the diameter of a head of a fetus. And later on, Theodore and Frederick, they attempted the ultrasound to diagnose brain tumors. And then in the 70s, we just have a boom. Now, this is how the early ultrasounds looks, very bulky, big. And today, ultrasounds look very, very simple, small, portable. You can even have them on your cell phone, and then you get what you want to do, get it done. And that has changed the perception and the expectation of neurosurgeons that now is easily being used in neurosurgery for many, many procedures in brain tumors, placements of EVD, shunts. And it can also help you to actually determine how much volume of tumor you've removed and where your catheter is placed or not. And as I said before, the beauty of ultrasound is that it's allowed live visualization of the structures, and it can be used alone. You don't actually need to have a neuro navigator before you use an ultrasound or intra-op MRI. You can use it alone, and it's a very good navigational tool. So typically when we talk of ultrasound, we're talking about a frequency above human hearing, that is about 20,000 hertz, or you can say 2 megahertz, sorry. And human cannot hear that. So this is how the probe works. I will just try to be as quick and simple. We have different modes in which the ultrasounds operate. So in mode A or aid mode, you can see if the blood, is my cursor being seen? So if we take this as the tissue, yes. You use the transducer, the cursor, you see the sound goes in and then returns, and this will be your mode A, and then you get whatever you want to see. So hand movement is very, very important in dealing with ultrasound. We also got the mode B, where you see the brightness, so B for brightness, and this is what on the right-hand side or left to your computers, you can see the brightness, and you can see how it will look in the ultrasound. Then you have the M mode, which signifies motion, which is movement. So thanks to this mode, you can actually see movement of blood in the tissues and X, Y, and Z. Then we also got the Doppler mode. And in the Doppler mode, I'm being very quick because I think I just have 20 minutes to do this. And the Doppler mode is one of the modes that generally we like to see, and they look nice because you have them in colors and all that. But it helps to quantify the direction and velocity of whatever we're doing. So we do have different type of Doppler modes. You have the pulse mode, you have the continual wave mode, and the advantage of the C mode is that unlike the power mode, it determines the flow and the velocity and accuracy. Then you have the Doppler display mode, and we can see the different modes here. Spectral mode, and which we are actually not going to talk about it, but it's just to show that in the Doppler mode, we have different type of modes. And the spectral mode is simply typically used to characterize the blood flow through the heart chamber. So cardiothoracic surgeons are more using that. And then you have the color Doppler, which is what we see. Now in the blue only shows that the data is going away from your transducer, and the red shows that the data is coming to your transducer, as we can see in the pictures. Now, the color Doppler is so good because it helps you to document the presence or absence of blood flow within the pathological lesion. So when you're operating a tumor and you use the ultrasound, you can actually see the blood flow, you can see the vessels, and it helps a lot to determine how much you can resect, where the challenge is, and what to do. With the power Doppler, it's a useful tool to examine low velocity blood flow, and it's more sensitive to flow than the color mode. So other modes, and one of the things that neurosurgeons would enjoy, would be the 3D and 4D scanning modes. And this is determined by the probe. The probe is about the 4D is about 7,500. And then one property we do have has to do with the elasto graphy, which has to do with when you're using neuro navigation and you use the ultrasound, you can pick up the difference. In our experience, we've seen 1 centimeter difference when you open the, you do the craniotomy, as to if you were just from the neuro navigator. So now the ultrasound can correct that brain shift once you do your craniotomy. So what kind of things can affect the image quality, the environment, the transducer, and then the system you use? We'll not go too much into that. I will talk a little bit of the line density, which helps to adjust the number of scan lines. You just have to keep trying to scan. Now, as I said, the ultrasound, actually, the most important thing about it has to do with the probe that you use. You have all these different probes. We use a lot of, I'll be talking about the probes that we use. But you have the liner probe, you have the sizes also matter depending on the procedure you're going to do. So the type of scans we have, the 3D, 4D, the color Doppler, we've already spoken about that. And then the properties of the images, why they form the reflection, refraction, absorption, and scattering. Because this is not a course, but just to give a talk and let us understand what we use it for, I'm talking about this, mentioning them to go ahead. Now, if you check here, ultrasound, when you talk of CT scan, you talk about the properties that we look on in echo. In ultrasound, we talk about echogenicity. And an echogenicity means that there is no echogenicity that is seen in the ventricles. Hypoechogenicity, normal white matter. Hyperechogenicity, we see that in tumor. We also have the homogenicity, where you see in low grade gliomas, and heterogeneous in high grade gliomas. And then you have this issue of demarcation that has to do with infiltrative versus non-infiltrative tumors that we see. So you have echogenicity, normal tissue, isodense that we'll be talking in CT scan, or isointense when you're talking about MRI. So you look at hyperechogenic issues, which is the brighter one you see in the files, the tentorium, choroid plexus. The echogenic will be the brainstem, and then the echogenic will be in the ventricles and the basal systems. So use of ultrasound intraoperatively, we use it for many things. It could be in the infections, trauma, VP shunt placement, vascular tumor cysts, combination with other neuronavigational tools. And now I'm coming to what we do in the Rich Hospital where I work currently. So we have a turning point. And the turning point, as I said, Prof. James, that I'll be talking about Dr. Mariela. She is the one you can see the arrow to. I've gotten some frozen machine a little. So you can see her, she's the one. Prior to her arrival in our hospital in 2021, we were only doing pre-op ultrasound or post-op. And that was being done either by the pediatricians or the radiologists. But she is a neurosurgeon, and she is a pediatric neurosurgeon with over 25 years of experience and has been using ultrasound for over 8 years. I'm happy she's online. So if there is anything, she can also talk to it. For some reason, the screen is gone.
We can still see your screen.
You can see my screen?
Yes,
we can.
All right, okay.
So did you have many more slides after this or not?
Yeah, sure, I do. I'm now going to talk about how we use it.
Oh, okay.
In our setup. But for some reason, good. Is it back? Is it seen?
We never lost good. It. We can see your screen. Good.
All right. So in our department, we started using the transoperator ultrasound in 2021 with the arrival of Dr. Infante. And as I said, she has a lot of experience with this. And then prior to that, we used to borrow our equipment. This is our first ultrasound. Let me see if the video can show. This was one of those things we're doing with evacuation of intraparenchymal hematoma. And we're using from the machine from our neonatal department. On the other side, you can see on this image where my cursor is, you can see us trying here to do post-op ultrasound to see the ventricles and to see the intracranial pressure. Then something happened dramatically that we recorded our first conjoined twins. And with that, we approached the government and were able to get our first ultrasound. And this is now the ultrasounds that we have in our setup. And this is our typical setup with the navigation. And then we try to couple the ultrasound, you can see, with the neural navigation system, with the CUSA, and with all the things that we do, the endoscope, and we tried and we keep trying to learn. Then we went ahead to try to measure the probes and see with our bare holes, if you have a probe, how the probe can go depending on the bare hole you use. If you place in a shunt, you know, this is the diameter, and then this is the kind of ultrasound you might want to use. Now, we have not received a 4D yet, but D probe yet, but we are working towards achieving one or acquiring one very soon. So we've used them in many of these procedures that you've seen listed, and I'll go through some of them bit by bit. So here you can see in hydrocephalus, we use it, EVD and shunts, we use it, it's daily, and we print out everything that we do. So here you can see in the in this video, you can see the ventricles and how we apply after that. You can see on your right side where the Kesa is, you can see our tools in there. In literature review, we've seen that there are a lot of catheter displacement and malfunction and revision. But with the ultrasound, you have the opportunity to get in once, and the revision rate is low. Here is a case, a patient who came with a stab wound. Obviously, you can't put this patient on an inside an MRI because you don't know what will happen to the knife. And in CT scan, you get artifacts as we see. And with ultrasound guided, we did the operation, went through the midline, and then we removed the knife without any challenges. And as you can see, and post-op, this is the patient walking when he came after the stab wound. So ultrasound has helped us together with other equipment that we use. We use it, as I said, in the intraparenchymal hemorrhage, especially in CVA, and with the navigation system, we're able to aim everything. And then we don't have to actually shave the ladies because they spend a lot of money with doing their haircut. We get this, measure the bare hole, and then we can see here, as we put, washing the clot, where you see the water come in, we can see the water. Let me see here again. As you clean the clot, you can see the water coming in excellently. Then here, you can see in hematoma lavage, let me see, you can see the water. You see the water coming out as it comes. Then you can see the grade of washing that you're doing in the hematoma. And then you are done. Post-op, we can use it to measure the intracranial pressure, as I said. And this is for the young ones. I mean, this is the future of neurosurgery when it comes to neuromonitoring. Then, as I said, you can continue on bedside if you're not satisfied, or it's a procedure with the ultrasound, you can do bedside. And this is the patient when he came 2 days after the surgery, you can see the difference. This case just happened yesterday and was operated on. This is a fracture. You can see multiple bilateral hematomas here. This is epidural, and this is intradural, intraparenchymal. You can see them. All right. So on one side, you do your craniotomy, you remove the hematoma. On the other side, you got the hematomas in there, and you can do another craniotomy. With the ultrasound, you come in, you can see, if you look at the CT scan, you see a cystic part of the hematoma, and you can see the solid part of the hematoma, which you can also see in the ultrasound. And then you can see the hematoma here, and through the ultrasound guidance, we evacuated this hematoma. So the cystic part will be the blue, the red part will be the hematoma. And then let me play this video. As you put, you don't need to do Y craniotomy. So you see this line is removal of the hematoma in one side, and then this side, the washing of the hematoma here. So we can see the ultrasonic component. You can see how it's being washed. So this patient, we don't have the post-op yet because it was yesterday. We're now doing the scan, but after that, you can see the parameters here, the BP, everything normalized, and we hope it does well. We also use it in gunshots, and this is a patient who came with all these bullets in his waist, and this is the point here. If you go to the MRI, you wouldn't know what to do, whether to the blood, the pellets will be MRI sensitive or not, they will be magnetic sensitive or not. And if you do CT scan, you get a lot of artifacts. We use the ultrasound. With the ultrasound from the skin, you can actually count, you can see the pellets, and you can actually count all of them, and you can measure the distance and everything. And this is a fluoroscopy. You can see some of the pellets actually moving inside the patient. Let me see towards the end. You see, they are moving. And in CT scan or MRI, you don't see that. Ultrasound helps. During the surgery, this is the ultrasound probe. We come in, and then with the ultrasound, we are able to perform the surgery. And then these are some of the pellets removed, as we can see. This is the patient postoperatively walking and without any big challenges. With it, we do a lot of awake surgery in my center, and we use the ultrasound to do the nerve blockades, as we can see. And this helps to keep the patient without pain. And this is brachial plexus that we repair. You can see the entry point of the knife. You can see where the patient is having the challenges. This is the MRI. This is the ultrasound version. When we did, you can see the vessels and everything. And then we get it repaired with our neuro. You can see with the stimulation of the nerves and with all, you get all that. Tumor resection, we use it every day, every single day. And the good thing is that you locate your tumor, you do your tractography, spectroscopy, you do your registration. We use the ultrasound immediately we do the craniotomy. So you do it before you open the dura. Then after opening of the dura, it guides you. And you can actually see your tools. You can see the tumor, and when you put your bipolar and it's emitting the heat, you can actually see your bipolar. You can see all the tools moving, and you can do your Doppler. You can see the vessels, the blood flow, and everything. So it really helps in visualizing the tumor and the surrounding structures adjacent to the tumor. It when you couple it with the navigation system, to me, it's almost like an MRI because you are seeing everything. And if you use the 3D probe, is better. Now, maybe those who have used ultrasound a lot on this platform can talk to this, because in our setup too, we use this to enhance the tumor visualization, but we've not used yet the contrast in the ultrasound. And we've been checking to see if there will be any contraindication or any reaction. So those who might, yeah, so I'll be talking about that. So we do that. Sorry, a message came and I was trying to read, and I'll talk about that in the question side. So we look at now using the contrast and using the 3D or 4D probe. This is our patient after resection of the tumor. So why ultrasound? Why am I interested for the younger generation? Because it's relatively cheap, easy to take to many places. We move it to ICU, to the ward, to the theater, everywhere, emergency. And it can be used alone, and no need to pause during surgery and say, I'm moving the patient to another room to do an MRI, or you need to record anything. Everything is live. The surgical tools can be seen. You can combine with other navigation. You correct the brain shift. It improves the, once we improve the image quality with training, then you can evaluate blood vessels and flow. Neurosurgeons can easily use it. In our setup, is we the neurosurgeons who use it. We don't call in the radiologists. It's cheaper in the installation. All you need is small gel and the probe, and then even with the water, the normal saline, you can enhance the imaging. You don't need nuclear people to can certify nothing. And they, of course, it has a learning curve, but the more you do, the more you learn. What are some of the challenges? Maybe the artifacts and the learning curve, but the more you use it, the more you get well versed with it, and then you can do more. So in our setup, we use the ultrasound, we use all the probes available, and then we also do some few 3D printing, which we're trying to see how we can combine that with the ultrasound and see how those can go. This ultrasound together with what we do has helped us do a lot of things, including virtual reality, using ultrasound tool and all that. So my message today is that nothing can get done at all if a man waited until he could do something so well that no one can find a fault. Just let's start doing what we can, small, small, little by little. We'll do what is possible, and suddenly we're doing what is we thought could not be possible. So this, the future is bright, and I think ultrasound should be incorporated. We are still learning. As I said, I only have 4 years in it. My mentor, Dr. Infante, is online. He has 8 years, and we are still learning in the country, and we never stop learning. I will pause here, but there is a question I will give to Prof. James so that you can moderate. Then I can answer the questions, and my colleagues who are online too can answer, and those with more experience can talk about it. Thank you.
Superb, superb job with real practical advice. Are there questions for Professor Kaba in the use of his instrument?
Raise his hand. Go ahead.
Hi, doctor. Sorry. It was excellent, and I'm sure everybody enjoyed it. But I have one quick question about the conjoint twin that he showed on the exam. Dr. Lazarev did the first conjoint separation at UCLA in US. If you can one time talk about it so he can share his experience, because that's a topic for the next generation of the neurosurgeon. And whenever Dr. Osman and Dr. Strada decide to talk about it, it's a beautiful case, and we really enjoyed your talk and that presentation.
Thank you, Ali. Anybody have questions for Professor Kaba?
Yeah, so I would say to my colleague that yes, thank you so very much, and sorry for the internet issues that the slides move back and forth. I just had to try to fix it to make the presentation. Maybe in the next round, when we get the opportunity, we'll be talking about the separation of the first conjoined twins in Ghana. And so I reserve that for when the rounds get back to us, we'll be talking about it. It's very important, and I think it's extremely wonderful experience any neurosurgeon can ever experience once in your lifetime. So we'll be talking about that.
Thank you.
Excellent, excellent presentation. Thank you, and excellent case for the practicality. I wondered if the Dr. Professor Mariel from Cuba, is she still available to make comment?
She's in there. Mariella?
We start to use the ultrasound with a child, because I'm working with a child with 20 years, for 20 years. And start with hydrocephalus. And later introduced, they use the ultrasound with the tumor resection, because the baby no has the hematoma. But when we arrive into Ghana, we start to using for evacuating the hematoma with good results, because it's a small hole and the result is very, very good. The proof that you depends, because if you need to see the flow, you use the plane. But if you use the hydrocephalus, I use the cure. How can I use? I use the glove, aesthetic glove. Previously, we add the gel, and the rest I cover with the cloth. It's sterile and it's secure. We not have the infection after they use the ultrasound.
Excellent. I wondered if you could comment on how effective the intraoperative ultrasound is for gauging the extent of tumor resection.
Let me take this before she comes in.
Sure.
Let me say, Dr. Professor Infante is a pediatric associate professor in neurosurgery, and she is in Ghana now in our center as a collaboration between the Ghana government and the Cuban government. So she's on a mission temporarily with us, and we've actually benefited a lot. This is an example of what we have benefited from. And a lot of questions also came in as to the probe. The best probe depends on what you're going to do. If you're going to do just a bare hole and a drainage of hematoma, you just need a small probe. We've evolved to the hockey sticks probe. If you look at some of the probes that are presented, they are able to allow you to actually navigate even inside the ventricles. And outside, if you use a small HCC probe, you can easily evacuate a cyst, you can evacuate an abscess, And then the liner probe is good. When you do craniotomy, you can see it. Then the probe, besides the probe too, depends on the type of machine you have. Some of the machines that you might have, we have one from GE, very excellent. And then the other one that you see there, Windsor. And depends on the quality of the machine. You need to actually talk to the vendor that you're going to use it for neurosurgery. Then they can actually accommodate it and put the apps for it to be for neurosurgery, or else they might configure it in a way you might not be getting good images. And because we are just using them for neurosurgery, we got the GE guys to come in. We bought it purposely for that. We got them to come in and accommodate it for, or accommodate them for neurosurgery. So we're getting good images. But we hope that with 4D, we should even improve better. Thank you.
I wonder if Ignatius is still here, because I can't see it on my screen. Ignatius, are you still here? There you are.
Yes, sir.
Do you use this, is this practical for you in Cameroon, or do you use it, or what's your experience?
No. I don't have any experience. I only saw it during my training, but I haven't used it.
Is it too expensive a device to get in Cameroon?
No.
Okay, so it's a matter of convenience, I guess. Professor Kaba, how expensive is it to get the proper ultrasound machine that you can use intraoperatively?
All right, so in Ghana, in my facility, is a public facility, it's a government hospital. So the government bought ultrasounds for primary healthcare. So we went into the ministry and we got one. And then the other one that we got, that was from the GE, the one that we can use the 4D probe. And usually the procurement is done by the ministry, so we can't say how much it is, but it ranges between $20,000 to $30,000, or you can get as much as $50,000. However, the simplest ultrasound machines, you can get them for $10,000, even $5,000. Those that they're using for primary healthcare, that you can actually couple it with your cell phone, they are going for almost $5,000. Even you can get them for $3,000. So it depends on the quality of the ultrasound you need. And the most important thing now will be the probes, because for some reason they sell with some standardized probes, and then when you want more probes, then they give you different prices for the probe. So for instance, the 4D probe I'm getting is going for $7,500.
What's the learning curve? Does it take how many patients, 10, 20 patients, to become comfortable with it? Or how do you establish experience?
All right. So in my personal experience, depending on the kind of procedures you'll be doing, but a neurosurgeon who spends, the more you do, the more you know. And as I said, I only have 4 years. I'm still learning. I'm still learning from Dr. Infante. I'm still learning from the internet. I'm learning from other conferences. But the more you scan, the more you get better. And in a week, if you do this in a week, you should be able to look into CVAs. You should be able to look into cysts. You should be able to look into the common diseases. But then you need more time to go into the vascular diseases. You need more time to go into the tumors and be able to differentiate between the tumor and the adjacent structures. So in a week, every neurosurgeon should be able to use it for simple procedures. And bedside, in a day.
Yeah. We were going to have Professor Mati from Iraq, Baghdad. He uses it extensively in tumor surgery, has had excellent results. He's not here. He's probably tied up, as is Samer Hose, who had an emergency procedure. So anyway, it looks like it's very valuable. You mentioned something, Professor Kaba. I remember when we were using the very expensive intraoperative neuronavigation systems, oftentimes by one out of three times it didn't work, or people didn't know how to use it. The ultrasound is just what you said in your talk. It's practical, it's easy to use, it's inexpensive, it's simple, and you can get a great deal of information. So I think don't be enamored by all the companies wanting you to spend expensive lots of money on something that you might find this is very helpful for. Now you have both. You have neural navigation and ultrasound. Which one do you use, or do you use both?
We combine them. We've actually calibrated to combine them. But for emergency cases, we use this time we use only the ultrasound. And I'm tending to like the ultrasound more than the navigation, because once the navigation, you don't have live surgery. I mean, after you open the brain and you even resect the tumor, you're still seeing the same. But the ultrasound, you see in life, and you are actually operating, and you're seeing how much tumor you're removing, how much blood you are evacuating, how much cysts you have. You see every little thing, how much saline you are pumping in. So I tend to like the ultrasound these days even more than the neuro navigation. And I think it's the future for neurosurgery. Thank you.
I think we have two questions up. Professor Mombali. You have some comments? Osue?
Wait a minute. Well, Said had his hand raised.
Yes.
Go ahead, Said.
Okay. I just wanted to mention about the ultrasound Doppler that our previous chair, Dr. Neil Martin, who used to do a lot of vascular anastomosis, ECIC bypass, he used the Doppler for verification of the patency of the artery, and after the anastomosis, he used that one, and I think it's something for the vascular surgeon to remember that Doppler ultrasound is very effective to verification of the patency of the anastomosis and the choice of the artery you are using to do the anastomosis.
You may need a different size probe, but it's a very good observation.
Yeah, that's one thing he used to do it, sir.
Estrada, it's 9:30. We started about 5 minutes after 8. And I think Samer, I'll just give you a short summary. Samer was going to talk to us, and we'll have him come back the next time about, I think, something that would be of interest to everybody, and that is using a smartphone. And he's a hybrid vascular neurosurgeon. He does interventional neurosurgery and standard neurosurgery. And they were using an interventionalist in Saudi Arabia helping guide people in Baghdad and other places using the smartphone to educate people beforehand, to go through the needs you have beforehand, and during the actual procedure to guide them through it. They did 29 cases. They've been very successful with it. So we're going to have him come and talk about it. It's something that seems very practical and can solve a lot of problems with personnel. Strada, you have any other thoughts or comments? I thought the two presentations were outstanding.
Well, I thought they were excellent. I think we're establishing a good foundation to build on. There was one question that my others may have in the chat about whether craniotomy or burr hole is needed for doing the ultrasound. If Dr. Kaba could briefly comment on that, then I think we can close.
Yeah, so actually there are two there. How do you maintain a sepsis while using the probe? So usually we use the same theater gun that we use to, we just put the cable in and then it's aseptic. And then we put the glove, as you can see, in the images, and then is completely aseptic. So there is no problem with that. Now, there are two ways. You have to do craniotomy, and then immediately you do the craniotomy. The best moment is to do the ultrasound before you open the dura. It helps you to locate yourself. It helps you to mark everything, and even helps you to also get the image and the surrounding structures. By then, if you were using only the neuro navigation, there would have been brain shift and you wouldn't be able to actually be in the same position, but the ultrasound will help you to see that very well. Now, there are moments, for instance, when we do post-op, when we are in the ICU, sometimes we can use the ultrasound to measure the flow of the middle cerebral artery. You just put the ultrasound there. That you don't need craniotomy. You put it right there, and you can see the flow. You can do the Doppler, and I agree with Professor Said. Whenever you do the Doppler mode, you can actually see the vascularization and how the blood flow is. So yes, during chemo surgery, do craniotomy, do ultrasound, open dura. You can do ultrasound again. Before we used to hold it whilst we operate. Now, and then you come in and out. But now you can actually have a system where you adapt it to the brain and you're operating. You don't need to be removing it back and forth. You have it on the brain and you're just operating and you see how much tumor you remove it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Luis. You're still here from Mexico. I see you're still there. Any comments on do you use intraoperative ultrasound? Any comments, any experience?
Yes, we use both. We use neuronavigation and ultrasound intraoperative, and it's a very remarkable tool for surgery. And we use it in cases of tumors and hydrocephalus as well, as the doctor presented the cases.
Do you use ultrasound more frequently than you use neuronavigation?
Both. We use both.
You use them both at the same time? Both.
Yes.
Okay, terrific.
In resecting tumors, we use both.
Okay, anybody else have any questions? Okay, well, Estrada, I think, Gilbert. Yes, Gilbert, yes, please.
No, just to say some words and congratulations and good presentations. Very, very impressive, very interesting and very informative. So we are waiting for the next courses, maybe in 1 month or 2 months. I don't know exactly when.
Thank you very much.
So along those lines, we're planning a regular recurrence on the first Sunday at the same time as this. So the program committee will meet in about a week to determine the agenda. But this is going to be a recurring forum every first Sunday of the month.
Okay. Well, so, I want to thank both Professor Caba and Kabula for their presentations, and Luis for commenting and joining us, and everyone else for coming. We hope you've enjoyed it. Estrada, any last comments?
No, excellent presentations, and I appreciate the very active participation. And I think we'll end it now, and look forward to the forum in a month, the first Sunday.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health-related problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit and to help us improve our programming. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions, comments, and requests for CME to ausman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. This foundation supports Surgical Neurology International, SNI. It is a 2D internet journal. Its editor-in-chief is Nancy Epstein, and the web address is sni.global. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is a new 3D video journal, interactive with discussion, and its web address is snidigital.org. Both are free on the internet 24/7/365. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories. It's the third largest neurosurgery journal in readership since 2010. And SNI Digital Innovations in Learning has now been viewed in 104 countries in 4 months It's the first video journal of neurosurgery. Our goal is to help people throughout the world. This is also supported by the Medical News Network, which is dedicated to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. This program is supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, a USA 501c3 operating charitable foundation. Copyright is 2024, all rights reserved. Thank you very much for watching.